Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
So let's not waste another minute. Settle in, sharpen your pencils, and check this out.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 359 for the week of June 14th, 2021. I am religiously indoctrinated 16th century French tween who's not freaked out by demonstrations of technologies century beyond their understanding, David Teagle, and I'm here with Waiting Room film strip Sarah D. Bunting.
Hope you kept your ticket.
70s flight attendant Tara Ariano.
Here's your bourbon and soda.
And world-dominating streaming service Richard Lawson.
That's a peacock joke.
Poor peacock. Yeah, welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Joining us today, he is Vanity Fair's chief critic. You've heard him on that magazine's Little Gold Men podcast, and still watching, you've also heard him here. It's Richard Lawson.
Richard.
Hello, Richard.
Welcome back.
Hello. Thank
Yay!
You. happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. So we're here to talk about Loki, and here's what you need to know, basically. It's the latest Marvel series on Disney Plus, where we pick up with the god of mischief, Loki, just after he used the Tesseract in one of the Avengers movies. In my notes, I have Who Cares, but then when I looked it up, it's Endgame.
I also have that in my notes.
No, it is Avengers Who Cares. That's the second one. Yeah.
He has used that Tesseract to zap himself out of custody and into the Gobi Desert, where suddenly a bunch of stormtroopers show up to collect him and the Tesseract and bring them back to the TVA, which is short for the Time Variance Authority, whose job it is to maintain the integrity of the sacred timeline, which Loki has violated. And after a formality of a trial, he is convicted, but then one of the TVA's agents, Mobius, played by Owen Wilson, intervenes to turn him into a consultant in the fight against an especially difficult variant Mobius has been pursuing. So three of us co-hosts have only seen the series premiere. Richard has also seen episode 2, which, as you're hearing this, has just dropped, so your spoiler exposure from this point forward is going to be quite low. Let us do the Chen check-in. Richard, should our listeners watch this show, in brief?
I mean, I'm loath to recommend anyone watch anything Marvel, because like some of it's great, but like there's just, you know, they don't need my endorsement. But as Marvel goes, I think it is one of the more fun entries. I've recently started at my house, because the person I live with insisted upon it, watching like the rebooted Doctor Who with Christopher Eccleston, and I'm finding it way more enjoyable than I thought I would. And Loki has some of that same DNA. So if you're into that kind of like cosmic, timey-wimey stuff, it's interesting in a way that a lot of other Marvel stuff isn't.
Okay. Sarah, you're not into that timey-wimey stuff, but what did you think of Loki? Should our listeners watch it, in your opinion?
I sure am-n't, but I still recommend it. When the second I saw D.B. Cooper in the trailer, I was like, fan. But like, I also live with someone who is much more up on a certain franchise than I. We had to pause Loki numerous times so I could be like, so in the timeline of the timeline, which timeline are we in right now? And he's like, well, I think, Ben, this is like Avengers Who Cares, followed by Avengers I don't even know. Here's the point. If the only one you ever saw was Thor Ragnarok and you're like, that one's funny, I like Loki now, this is a good show for you. Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it. But I would say, yes, even if you're not a Marvel person, this is a good show.
Dave.
Yeah, I like that framing. If you're like a Ragnarok, then this Loki is probably also your jam. So I think I would go with that. Well, I am enjoying it. A nice change after the last super shitty series, the Peanut Butter Millennium Falcon and the Snowman, which was super terrible. So like I said last week, I was ready for something popcorn-y. And so far, this fits the bill.
Mm-hmm. I'm like Richard. I hesitate to throw any endorsements to the Marvel Industrial Complex.
Mm, sure.
Especially after I didn't watch Falcon and the Winter Soldier other than the first episode that put me to sleep. But at the end of WandaVision really soured me on this whole project because it was so fucking boring. But so far, at least based on the premiere, I would say yes, you should watch Loki.
Yeah.
All right. Richard, I listened to your episode of Still Watching about the premiere, and I was so happy to hear you liken the TVA to the Adjustment Bureau. The stars of one of my favorite OK movies, although now I'm not going to be able to stop thinking about the Adjustment Bureau show we're never going to get because no one liked that movie except me. So my question to you, what do you think makes the idea of a predestination bureaucracy so appealing for creators?
Because it's a way to talk about God without talking about God. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that everything is preordained and that there is some sort of supernatural entity or entities presiding over that organization is a lot of, you know, major faiths around the world. That is a core tenet of their belief, is that there is a sort of plan. But that stuff can get into, like, you know, Kevin Sorbo, Roma Downey territory, if right. you go directly at God. So why not talk about space and people who control time and whatever? Because it, you know, it's all about, like, existential questions. And what I like about Loki compared to other Marvel stuff, which is much more about, you know, American government and military and all that, that's obviously, there are shades of that in this, authority versus rebels or whatever. But this is a bit more, like, universal and, I think, at least what I've seen, the politics aspect of it is a bit more, like, generous and humane. I think it's just really grappling with very, very old questions in a more contemporary vernacular.
Okay. And so I agree that I think that's a great take. Can we all just also talk for a second about the look of the TVA? Because knowing from Richard's colleague Joanna Robinson's interview with head writer Michael Waldron that Mad Men is one of his favorite shows, and Catch Me If You Can was an inspiration for this. It makes a lot of sense when you actually see it. Richard, did you also find this very pleasing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that, like, that the look of it and everything is yet another way that Loki, compared to Falcon and the Winter Soldier, even WandaVision in some senses, like, has a real point of view.
Yeah.
And yes, that point of view is borrowed from everything ranging from Adjustment Bureau to Wes Anderson to, you know, myriad things. But it's all, the quilt is stitched together, I think, pleasingly.
Sarah, sounds like you loved it too.
I mean, you're never gonna go wrong bunt nip wise with a mid-century production design. And I think that's also, this is sort of like effortlessly appealing to a certain kind of person who, like, part of the appeal of the D.B. Cooper mystery also was like, now that it's 50 years ago, we're never going to know. But also it had an elan to it. That I think folds in well with the Loki character, and they make that explicit in the premiere episode.
Yeah.
But I think it's also smart to sort of give you cool, like, mod era tape machine shit to look at, possibly to distract you from the fact that this is white collar meets Sophie's World. And, like, if you think about that for too long, yeah, your head will blow up because you're like, but also this is a Marvel property and fuck you. I just want to sit here and look at pretty people going through time and space. But the production design was fantastic. And Owen Wilson, the design of Owen Wilson's nose does suggest a higher power. What that higher power is up to, I cannot say, but a lot of variance control bureaus at work to construct that beautiful thing. What did we think of Owen Wilson and this role against Loki?
Richard, why don't you start?
Well, I mean, it's great to see him with a big role like this again. You know, he took some time off from working. And I think he fits it well. I mean, something I've talked about with Joanna on our podcast about Loki is that there is a lot of exposition here. There is a lot of kind of, you know, time travel theory, interdimensional stuff. It's a lot for like a lay viewer like myself. I'm not steeped in the comic book lore to kind of absorb in one or two episodes. But having someone like Owen Wilson, who's so affable and familiar and friendly seeming with a kind of wry twinkle in his eye, be the one to communicate that helps a great deal. I don't know where his character goes past serving that function, mm-hmm. which is one of the great questions I have about the show, is like, is he going to turn out to be bad? I suspect the whole TVA as an entity is probably going to be, at the very least, like, you know, amoral to a kind of dangerous extent. But where Mobius, the character played by Owen Wilson, factors into that, I don't know. But I am intrigued enough because he is such an offbeat presence in this, you know, slickly designed world.
I was kind of surprised how much they went into predestination on this first one, because I feel like that notion doesn't really jive with a franchise that's all about thwarting evil and saving the day. Like, the fact that this is all supposed to be the way it happens really doesn't, like, fit in with the drama of good versus evil. Mm.
Well, and you're also, it's like, well, let's explore the Calvinist nature of the Marvel Universe out loud in front of the kids. Interesting choice.
Yeah, yeah.
So I suspect what's going to happen is the TVA is actually going to, like, there'll be a discovery there that the TVA is actually keeping the time goodies for themselves in some way, and that this Loki will be the anti-hero that sort of exposes the TVA for what it is, or at least their worst habits, and that this idea that everything is predestined, that must follow this one way, will be undone by the end of the series. Because mm-hmm. I just, like, fundamentally can't see that jiving with the rest of, like, just the mood and just the basic structure of a comic book entity.
Well, they also tip, you know, what side they're on when the first sight we see of any TVA action is, like, basically police brutality against Loki, which I know is often a punchline in these movies, which is a different problem. But, like, yeah, their styling and their tactics certainly don't suggest a benevolent intent. So I agree with Richard.
While, though, the TVA exists, this is my bold, obviously going to be super wrong because I always do Marvel show prediction of the month. But because they're dealing with alternate timelines here, kind of like WandaVision did, and that they're going to have a certain amount of malleability as far as, like, what they can introduce, I am now going to boldly and incorrectly predict that there will be a short Deadpool cameo during this run.
Okay.
Put it on the books.
I mean, I don't think that's off base, because I think, you know, one of the best features for the creators of the TVA is that it allows them to unravel or re-ravel as many timeline threads as they want. And then they could just, like, fix it in post.
This show is fix it in post.
Yeah. This show is the post that, like, they're fixing all the other, that it's like, but wasn't she dead by then? And is that her hologram twin? I'm lost. And okay, Loki will fix it in episode 4. It's a pretty sweet con if you think about it.
Loki as a TV show is, like, opportunity for all the retcon they want to do and package it in a impish, smiley kind of way that wasn't acute that. So if they got any problems that they need to fix now for their phase 14 or whatever the fuck they're going to now with their movies, like, this is the show that they can do it in. And I wouldn't be surprised if they do.
Can we get a Chen check-in on this iteration of Loki's hair?
I like it better than the long hair, personally.
Interesting. I think there's too much gel. Richard?
Well, we had erroneously claimed on our podcast that it was a wig, and then we got many, many emails being like, with photo evidence of it not being a wig, that Hiddleston had, or Tim Hiddlesworth, as my mom calls him by accident. She texted me to say she was excited to see Loki with Tim Hiddleston.
Oh, sure. And a Tim Cumberston.
Exactly. That's his mom name. Yeah.
The hair is good. I mean, obviously Hiddleston is, like, attractive. The Loki character is kind of fun, rakish. He's always been a little, I'm not, like, into it in that way. Maybe the hair is part of it. I don't know.
Well, since we talked about his appeal to you personally, Richard, you also talked about the show making his gender fluidity canon when we see the actual paperwork on his TVA file. But as you also noted in that podcast, Disney's promotion of these representation moments have generally been much more overblown than what actually makes it to screen. What is your level of optimism here?
Well, you're asking me at a funny time because I am kind of starting to write something that will be up by the time this podcast is live, but about Luca, the Pixar movie, which like has been sort of coded or advertised, maybe like a shadow advertising campaign, as like Pixar's gay allegory movie. Mm-hmm. There's also like the premiere of Love, Victor on Hulu, which was originally supposed to be on Disney Plus. The Cruella character, who was kind of touted as being non-binary or queer in some way, and like, and all of it feels a little bit like, okay, but you know, where's the actual substance there? You can't just point at a character and say they're blank, you know, in J.K. Rowling style, and then move on. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, there is something that happens in the second episode that like expands on that idea as of Loki as a fluid being. That, yeah, it could be interesting. I know that the fans, because this is, I think, canon in the comics about Loki's gender identity, they're really expecting that. But I think thus far, I think Marvel has been quiet-ish about it. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe because it's like spoilery. I don't know.
Hmm. I'm not a fan theory person. Quite the opposite. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention one that you and Joanna talked about, which is Mobius possibly a hidden Loki? What do we think, Dave?
That sort of makes sense. At the end of the first episode, he does say, this is something that puzzled me. So maybe this kind of, my gears are turning a little bit after he said that. So at the end of the, near the end of the first episode, Mobius says, the variant we're hunting is you, bomb, bomb, bomb. So in theory, there's another Loki running around. And this, I assume, will be the Loki that is achieving all his greatest dreams and aspirations to become God King of the universe, et cetera, et cetera. And that, yeah, so if Mobius is actually that Loki in disguise trying to re-engineer events inside the TVA to make it possible for his agent out in the timeline to make that happen, that makes sense. And that would be a decent twist. I can get behind that. Well done, Richard. Because I thought it was strange at the end of the first episode that he says that, and then there's this like denouement action scene that takes place in Oklahoma, where supposedly this variant Loki that they're hunting does all this stuff, but they don't show him, even though they've already pre-announced that that is, you think, going to be Loki.
Right.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that there's something a little fishy there.
There's also the fact that, like, that, you know, he leaves the remote on the table. Like, that just doesn't seem like that character would do that unless that's
what was supposed to happen, to use timekeeper language.
Well, yeah, but also that, you know, they are sort of two sides of the same coin. But this is something that I had in my notes and something that we paused it to talk about, me and Dan, in terms of how they did this on Samurai Jack, which is like my frame of reference for kind of everything.
Right.
Weirdly, in terms of like pop culture, dealing with questions of deism, that but that show tipped you to Aku's having shapeshifted because the color scheme of the characters would always be similar. So now I'm going to be looking for that. And I was looking for it in the rest of the episode, but it's like this, because it was mid-century, it was all sort of washed out colors and it was hard to tell based on that. But I don't know. I don't think that's a bad fan theory comparatively.
The showrunner for this show is also involved in Kevin Feige's Star Wars project.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So if you're liking what's going on here, it bodes well for that particular movie that's coming up.
He is an interesting figure in that he's pretty young. He's like 34, so he's a lot older than all of us, but he's for the industry, he's young. But he got plucked out of like film school and then got hired for this. And then Feige was like, you're my new golden child. And now he's writing a bunch of other things. And I'll be curious to see if he can sustain that momentum.
It's time to go around the dial talking about something we've been watching on TV lately. First up, Tara.
I got two TV rom-coms. First, I'm about to spoil the shit out of the series finale of Younger. So if you haven't been keeping up on Hulu and Paramount Plus, or, you know, you're just going to watch it when it comes to TV Land this week, stop listening.
Spoilers ahoy!
Thank you. Charles and Liza get back together in the penultimate episode, and then they break up again in the finale because he can't trust her because she lies? The big lie was exposed on the show so long ago. Like, they don't really make it like he breaks up with her, I guess. It's just sort of they both are like, this isn't going to work. I agree. And then that's it. But by the way,
yikes.
Josh, Nico Tortorella, did not even show up until there was only 9 minutes left in the episode, right around the time I was wondering, wait, is Josh even going to be in this? And frankly, Josh could have sat this one out, in my opinion. But they have a moment at the bar at the end where it's a reprise of their initial meeting in the premiere, which cute, I guess. But like, Josh and Liza broke up for many good reasons. And the fact that Josh wanted a baby and she didn't is only one. Like, their other differences didn't just get erased by his having a baby with some other fucking broad. Also, it's a series finale. I know schedules, blah, blah, but you could not even get Diana back on FaceTime. We're supposed to think this character would skip the 100th anniversary of this company. Like, I'm ready to write this whole season off as non-canon on the basis of her not being in it alone. But if you want to make a statement by having your lead end up alone, which Darren Star obviously has done before, Kelly Taylor choosing herself. You could at least make her affirmatively dump him for still not trusting her rather than this dumb mutual simultaneous agreement. Like, this is a romantic comedy. Do you even know what you are doing here? Thank God this week brought us a romantic comedy that did know what it's doing here, which is Starstruck on HBO Max. Thank you. This was created by and stars New Zealand's Rose Matafea, who also has a stand-up special called Horn Dog on HBO Max, which we'll link to in the show notes and is great. She was also in Series 9 of Taskmaster, where she was a totally game goofball, so we stan. Here she's playing Jessie, an underemployed 20-something who stayed in London after undergrad, and she's out at a club for New Year's Eve when she has a meet-cute with a guy named Tom and goes home with him and then realizes the next morning he's a hugely famous movie star. Tom, by the way, is played by the very hot Nikesh Patel from the Four Weddings and a Funeral TV show on Hulu that was bad.
Okay. I was like, oh, this sounds cute, but I'll never watch it. Oh, hello. Yeah.
He looks real good. So She's freaked out. He's still interested. They see each other again, but then there's a complication. And months go by between episodes, which reflect the probable reality of what that situation would be like, given his work and stuff. And more complications arrive. Sometimes she fucked up, sometimes he does. And while this could be off-puttingly Mary Sue in the execution, it is completely credible that they're both into each other. The banter is choice. And if all of that hasn't convinced you to watch it, Minnie Driver shows up as Tom's awful agent in episode 2. And each of the 6 episodes is under 22 minutes long. So if you've been missing rom-coms in movie form, good news. This series is about the same length as one and better than most of the quickie ones that Netflix makes. All of them, frankly. The romance hits, so does the comedy, which is just as important. And unlike other female-driven British comedies like Fleabag and This Way Up and Afterlife, I know Aslingby is Irish, but the show's set in London, which I also like very much. This one is not sad. Like, those have their place, too. They're great, but this one isn't sad. It's just worth noting. And I was going to talk about Hacks, which just ended its excellent first season on HBO Max, but I feel like Hacks has gotten a lot of attention elsewhere, and Starstruck deserves some shine. It really is very special, and you will love watching it, but watch Hacks as well, especially if you like the other two. Also, watch the other two. It's on HBO Max, too.
I think if you were let down by that Four Weddings and a Funeral, this is the show to watch.
Yes.
Because I felt like watching, I was like, I think this is what they were trying to do with Four Weddings and a Funeral Hulu version and could not.
Mm-hmm.
And this was good. I mean, rom-coms could take or leave them, but I watched them all in a row.
We did. Yep. For my plug, Santiago mentioned in the last episode, Kevin Can Fuck Himself. I reviewed it for Primetimer.com, and we will link that in the show notes.
Richard, what do you got?
Okay, I think last summer I was going to talk about an HGTV show and then change my mind at the last minute because I'm like, well, how much are those shows about gentrification? So I, because the one I was going to recommend is called Bargain Block, which is about this gay couple in Detroit renovating homes and selling them at a very, very, you know, affordable price point so people can start, you know, building equity. And, you know, they're trying to basically redress wrongs done to the city of Detroit and the people of Detroit, largely black. But they're a white couple, and I think some of their designs get very Trading Spaces-y. Mm. So I find the show fascinating, but I'm not sure if it is a force for good in the world. So instead, I don't know if you guys have talked on the show about Crime Scene Kitchen, hosted by Joel McHale.
We did a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I'll just say quickly then that I've been enjoying that improbably because like loud Fox competition shows are not at all in my wheelhouse anymore, if they ever were.
Yeah.
But it's unexpectedly charming and cute and fun. And McHale is just the right kind of like, hey, I'm still a comedian. Remember, you know, he knows he's doing a cash gig, but like he's still funny without being overbearing. So That's what I've been into.
Has anybody died yet? I tuned out after the first one, but have they actually?
Every episode since the premiere. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's actually really gruesome, but you know,
actually it's the viewer who dies.
Right, a little bit.
Loud Fox reality show is the perfect way to describe all of those. Just based on the promos alone.
I mean, somewhat redundant perhaps, but we'll allow it.
No, it's perfect. And what do you have to plug? We will link to your Twitter, but what else?
Well, you know, as ever, my book, All We Can Do Is Wait, is for sale, at penguinrandomhouse.com. Also, speaking of HGTV, I have a feature that was in the June issue of Vanity Fair called Home Truths, all about the home design reno show boom, talking with HGTV people, Netflix people, some talent, and just trying to do a survey of that strange, and ever burgeoning genre and economy. So if people want to read more about that, they can go to vf.com, and we'll have a link, I guess, in the show notes.
Yes, I will link it.
Charity, buddy.
Okay, so The Housewife and The Hustler. Which am I? Just kidding. This is about Erika Jayne and Tom Girardi and that whole mishigas. It is a documentary. Hulu lists it as like season one, episode one, but it's like, where could this go? I was like kind of excited. Oh, maybe there's more episodes about this guy being a total fraud. No, it's, you know, it's just an hour and 10 minutes. It's actually a decent overview of the, you know, pretty nauseating allegations against Tom Girardi. If you don't follow this particular franchise or don't know why this is a headline, part of it is that Tom Girardi, who is an embattled attorney, aged 82, was capital T, capital G, the guy in the Aaron Brockovich case, and was a name before he started showing up in the background slash behind the kitchen island in Erika Jayne's home. Part of it is that he is accused of skimming from client escrow to finance Erika Jayne's so-called music, so-called career. Mm. Part of it is that the timing of Erica's filing for divorce at the end of last year is very suspect. And as one of the Talking Head interviewees says, we love to see the fall with these kind of people. But it's kind of a weird watch. Like, it comes from ABC News, which is like obviously not bad at this sort of reporting. But it's a pretty sober-sided gray flannel organization, like the kind of total opposite of the Bravo ecosystem. So the tonal fit is a bit odd. It's both too focused on Erika Jayne as the hook to get people to watch this thing and like not focused enough on whether her various pop music, hot messery, Donnie Brooks may have encouraged Tom Girardi to get into this mess, or at least get deeper into the kind of mess that he was already making, according to the California Bar Association. The lead-off Talking Head interview is from an almost unrecognizable Danielle Staub. Like, this is, quote, my Housewives franchise, New Jersey. I still did not recognize her until she started talking and doing that I'm better than everyone preening thing she does. So that's uncomfortable to watch, like even more than usual with Danielle Staub. And I guess the fact that she and Erica both worked at the same Lodi, New Jersey strip joint is supposed to make her some kind of forensic expert in this situation. But that's kind of skimmed over. And another weird Talking Head interviewee is Christopher Darden. Yeah, that Christopher Darden. He gets like 1.5 sound bites. Also, it's like he looks well. It's weird. But another Talking Head interviewee who sort of makes the whole thing worthwhile is Vanity Fair's own Chris Murphy, who wrote a really good piece a couple months back about whether by watching these shows and their aspirational overspending, we, the audience, are complicit in creating these fraudsters who need to maintain these wasteful appearances by any means necessary. I had already added that link to our show notes before I even watched this documentary. And then there he was. So it was gratifying to see him on camera. I wouldn't exactly recommend this documentary, but it's fine. It's just a little flabby and predictable. And if you want to get caught up on the case and get some knitting done also, it's like it's fine for that. As a documentary about this, it misses some opportunities, particularly about examining Girardi's putative diminished capacity defense when the Bar Association has been fielding complaints of this nature for decades. So this is probably BS, but whatever you think this is, that's what it is. And there you go. I would actually recommend reading the Murphy piece instead. It is faster. Speaking of reading, I run a true crime only bookshop. It's called Exhibit B Books, and everything tagged major case is on sale this week. You've still got a couple days to get 13% off all of those materials. That's exhibitbbooks.com. And yes, as a matter of fact, Christopher Darden's memoir is in stock right now and eligible for the discount. Exhibitbbooks.com. I hope I'll see you there.
All right. Well, Tara brought it up very briefly. It's not TV, but HBO Max has the Japanese movie House. Whew. If you want to watch something and go, what the fuck did I just watch, but still be entertained, that's your movie.
Crazy.
Cool.
all right. Here's what's coming up on Extra Hot Greatses. On the next EEHG, it's game time on your time. Not quite sure what it's going to be yet, but it's going to be a game time that you can play all by your lonesome at your leisure without other people giving you the answers. Then on this show right here, EHG Prime, next week, we get physical with Jeb Lund.
Today's extra credit topic is called Send in the Clowns. It's from David Ellis Dickerson, who writes, take a show and add a clown. The clown can be evil or sad, and it must either kill or be killed. Explain how this improves the show. I'll go first. This week, I also reviewed for Primetimer a game show on TNT called The Cube. Remember, we talked about Small Fortune a couple weeks ago? This is Small Fortune, but it's big and in a cube. It's basically the same thing. Where, like, you're playing against the clock or your nerves or whatever. There's no opponent. And there are teams, but this time the teams are two. It's too stupid to bother describing to get into, like, the nitty-gritty of it. The only thing you need to know is all of the games take place in this cube. And I don't deny the games are hard. I'm sure I could not do any of them, but I didn't apply to be on the show. And if I had, I would probably spend some time before the application watching clips of the British version to practice the skills required, since they all fall into a few buckets like eye-hand coordination, quick math, spatial reasoning, and balls, catching, bouncing into a goal, whatever, ball stuff, ball handling. The stakes of the show as it currently exists are either you win some money or you don't. But if you were in the titular cube with a clown who would immediately kill you if you failed at the task, it would probably sharpen a lot of people's focus who really need it, in my opinion. Sarah.
Okay. Adding a killer clown to Hannibal is probably redundant. But first of all, it improves the show because it means the show is, you know, back on and in production. But honestly, if any scripted show is going to do a nuanced take on John Wayne Gacy and the power of illusion that protects corn-fed looking white dudes from law enforcement consequence for decades on end, it is Hannibal. Plus, I could see Lecter serving Will et al. A clown roast. And instead of the little hats on the clown roast, it's like little clown hats or party hats. And then Riley answering Will's question as to his combative interactions with his clown patient by commenting that they made up. And then pouring Will a glass of seltzer from a flower button on his lapel. I'm here all week. My shoes are size 26. Richard.
Well, as you might be able to tell from my HGTV obsession, I'm also obsessed with Discovery Plus, the streaming service that now soon will be part of Warner, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so there's a show on that called Chopped Next Gen, Next Generation, where it's younger, like up and coming fine cuisine chefs competing in the regular, you know, like sea cucumber and cotton candy or whatever the challenges are. Add a clown, put a clown in the basket and see what I'm not saying they have to butcher the clown, but I mean, maybe they could. But just like, what would the distraction of a clown just standing over their prep station do to the competition? And also the visual, the Mary Poppins visual of them pulling a whole clown out of the basket.
Oh my God, amazing.
Hat first.
Love it. Hat first.
Incredible.
All right, I'll wrap this up. You ever watch MASH and think, oh boy, it's really hard to figure out what Hawkeye is thinking. I wish that guy would emote more. Let me know when he's happy or angry or sad or whatever. Enter Corey the Clown. Corey follows Alan Alda's Hawkeye around the hospital base and wherever else he goes to embellish his, like, drunken, impish silliness or dark philosophical moods. Here's an example. In the terrible finale, if you may recall, the bus scene.
Yes.
With the mother who can't keep her baby quiet while there's enemy forces about. And Alan Alda's Hawkeye is, like, whisper yelling at her to keep the baby quiet. Corey the Clown violently squeezes his horn every time Hawkeye does that. So he's like, keep your baby quiet. And then later on in the episode when we discover she actually smothered the baby, spoiler, Corey's face makeup turns sad. And he puts, like, a big gloved hand on Hawkeye's shoulder, squeezes out a low, slow, mournful honk. At the end of the episode, as Hawkeye leaves Korea forever, Corey has served his purpose, but chases after him up on the hill where the landing pad is with the helicopter that's taken him away. No. Jumping for the helicopter, giant spring-powered clown shoes catapulted him directly into the blades, showering Hawkeye with clown blood. And that's the story of Corey the Clown.
Okay.
It is time for the canon. Our guest Richard is presenting this week. Back to the Basics. Take it away, Richard.
So my canon submission is my favorite episode of what, for about a 10-season run, was my favorite show ever, and probably still one of the greatest shows ever made, that run of it anyway, which is The Simpsons episode Summer of 4'2", which was the season finale of season 7. It aired about 12 days before my 13th birthday. And a couple summers previous, I had spent some time with a good friend and his family in Agunquit, Maine, where they had rented a house. And it's this charming little seaside town, and just kind of a magical experience, but a strange one, because we were sort of tween age, and like our paces of growing up were different. And his older brother had all these like scary friends who were like smoking weed, and I thought they were kind of cute, but I didn't know that I thought that then. You know, it was a very, very jumbled time in life. And what I think Summer of 4'2" gets beautifully is that liminal space of childhood where you want the independence, but you're still kind of, you know, comforted by home and parents and that little cozy dynamic. But you're also starting to realize that there is more of a social world out there for you to explore. And that's mostly viewed through the lens of Lisa in this episode. But the other kids, Bart and Milhouse, who is the friend who tags along to the beach house, are also, I think, really beautifully explicated in this episode. I think the show, right from the jump, keenly understands the sort of subtle differences, you know, between two kids who are the same age. One is a little more childish. One is trying to be a little more grown up and savvy and all that, which is clip number one. We hear Bart and Milhouse.
Hey, Bart, summer's almost here. Which kind of sprinkler do you like? The one that goes like this? Or the one that goes like this? Oh, and there's this one.
The last day of school, Milhouse. Try to show some dignity.
And the idea that Milhouse doesn't have dignity because he's just being a goofy kid excited for summer is like a little bit of a bummer, but it's so true to the way that kids are, you know, especially at that time when they're trying to maybe act a little cool and, you know, not be so, I guess, just childish. And I think this episode is, in addition to being really smart about how it depicts, you know, the changing evolution of yourself when you're that age, it's also really, it kind of reaffirms or shores up a lot of the social dynamics seen in the show, like how characters interact with one another, who those people are in relation to themselves and to the world around them. And we've always known Lisa to be a sort of a hero. She's not, you know, there was that whole controversy with Ted Cruz where he was talking about how no one liked Lisa and all this stuff. And I think, at least in those beginning seasons, Lisa was the sort of humanist hope of the series. She was the heart of the series. She was the kind of intellect trying to like better her family's life, her community's life, and her own. But, you know, she was also kind of annoying, and the show was very sharp, and this episode can be very sharp about pointing that out in maybe slightly cruel fashion, which is clip 2.
In the beginning of the school year, each of you received a colored ticket. I hope everyone still has theirs.
Who died and made you boss?
Mr. Estes, the publications advisor. I edited the whole thing.
If you hadn't done it, some other loser would have, so quit milking it.
A hard reality from Nelson Muntz. Also, R.A.P. Mr. Estes. That social mapping is not specific. It's not only for the kids in this episode. There also are some funny, less prevalent, but still there, details with the adults, Homer, Marge, and how they relate to Ned Flanders. I didn't pull a clip of it, but later when they go into the house, that it's actually Ned Flanders' house that they're kind of staying in for these 2 weeks. And he's left little post-its everywhere saying, like, how do you, and Marge opens the freezer and then the ice cream drawer, and it says filming, and she goes, "What with what, Ned?" And then she pulls it back and it says with water, and she rolls her eyes. So Marge can even be a little judgmental and snide. But anyway, but Ned, you know, sweet, poor Ned, is kind to the last. And, you know, Homer strikes this deal as if getting a free beach house was like somehow a burden on Homer. And he's like, "Well, you have to check out my septic tank," which we hear a brief result of that in clip 3.
Hello, Mr. Brown Ground.
I mean, there.
Hello, Mr. Brown Ground. He's
justice for Ned.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little moment that I had to include. It doesn't really make my case for me, really. But
no, but you also didn't ask for the squelching, but it felt important to me when I got the
call. Oh, 100%, 100%. So as Lisa faces this opportunity to, you know, she has this yearbook catastrophe where no one signed her yearbook, even though she worked so hard on it. It's very sad, very relatable. She's decided that this couple weeks away is going to be her chance to reinvent themselves. And I would argue that, you know, maybe we weren't all so privileged as to get to go to a nice beach house for a week or two, but we had a summer where we were sort of removed from the continual daily pressures and sort of understandings of school, and we could reinvent ourselves. We could get a new haircut. We could grow up a little bit. You know, every fall that some kid would come back taller or with a deep voice or whatever those changes were, either organic or forced on behalf of, you know, on the kid's part. So Lisa makes this plan to change her whole identity, but before that has to kind of reckon with who she was prior to that, which is clip 4.
Well, did you call one of your friends?
Friends? Huh. These are my only friends. Grown-up nerds like Gore Vidal. And even he's kissed more boys than I ever will.
Girls, Lisa. Boys kiss girls.
Mom, why don't I have any friends?
We have each other. When I was a lonely little girl, I always dreamed that someday my daughter would be my best friend.
We are best friends, Mom. But I'm a kid. I need friends my own age, too.
Honey, you'll make plenty of friends. All you have to do is be yourself.
Be myself? I've been myself for 8 years and it hasn't worked. Look at all these dorky clothes. A bathing cap. Nose plugs. A microscope at the beach? Ugh! What was I thinking?
So, embedded in that, you know, Lisa kind of being like, "I'm such a dork, what was I thinking?" is a really sweet dynamic between her and Marge, where the show is not making fun of Marge's kind of, you know, helicopter parenting, nor is it making fun of Lisa for having, you know, enjoyed that attention for most of her childhood. It's just kind of understanding that Lisa is perpetually 8 years old, but I think we can understand her as being anywhere from 8 to 12, you know, in this episode. She's saying that, like, this is nice, but there has to be something else. And I think that's so poignantly rendered throughout the episode. I also think that, you know, the hindsight might say, oh, that joke about Marge saying, you know, girls, boys kiss girls. But I think that, like, what it's showing is that, like, Marge does have her conservativeness, her sort of traditional thinking, but she's not being kind of scolding about it. She's just kind of relating how she sees the world to Lisa. And I think there's something very human in that, especially as the episode goes. And, you know, Homer can be a little mean to Milhouse, but everyone's mean to Milhouse. Speaking of, while Lisa is going through her big changes and buying new clothes and trying to make friends with Christina Ricci and a couple other, well, a character voiced by Christina Ricci, Bart is getting increasingly resentful of this new independent, you know, aspirationally cool Lisa, which is another really relatable sibling dynamic, especially for siblings so close in age, where and siblings who are so diametrically opposed in kind of their worldview and how people receive them. So as Lisa makes her forays into the world, Bart is trying to reassert his status as like the cool, dangerous one. But what this episode, which is written by Dan Greeney, understands so keenly is that Bart is still a kid too. And he is still sort of rooted in a very childish understanding of rebelliousness that is not maybe going to suit him so well as he enters his soon, you know, to arrive teen years. So we get a little snippet of that in clip 5.
Hey, Bart, Lisa's skateboarding with some cool kids. And she looks like Blossom.
Lisa? With people? If they're impressed by her, I'm gonna Bart their world. Okay, Milhouse, you know the drill.
Right. You go over and wow them. I hide in the shrubs.
Hot stuff coming through. My friendship, you know you want it.
That kid, like, tries too hard.
Sure. The whole thing smacks of effort, man.
That's my dorky little brother, Bart. Tholomew.
Like, who does he think he is with that slingshot in his back pocket? Dennis the Menace?
Like Mr. Wilson or something.
How'd it go? Are we down with them?
No. They must have seen you.
Poor Milhouse really gets the brunt of the abuse in this episode, which is kind of leading us into the next clip. But before we hear it, I you know, Milhouse is kind of, you know, treated a bit cruelly, but I do still like the way that we see Milhouse interacting with Homer, which is kind of a rare occurrence on this show, I feel like. And once again, it's this episode really taking advantage of the complex social dynamics the show had built, you know, in the seasons previous to this, where we know enough about Milhouse, we know enough about Homer and Marge and Bart to really get why they're pinging off of each other in this particular way that they are in this episode. Even if we don't see this dynamic repeated again later in the show, it still makes credible sense and is also really funny and provides a really sweet moment where Homer just kind of like goes with the flow with this silly game that they're playing on the porch in this lovely beach house. So that's clip 6.
Oh, why do we have to play this lousy old game?
Because it was the only one in the house. Come on, Homer, open the door for your mystery date.
Ooh, captain of the football team. He's a dreamboat. Don't wait up, Marge.
Okay, Bart, your turn. You got the dud!
Hey, he looks just like you, Poindexter.
How come Lisa doesn't have to play? Why does she get to hang out with her friends?
You got friends, you got the dud right here. Stand up for yourself, Poindexter.
Homer doing a little, para-parenting there with Milhouse, even though he's the one who has labeled Milhouse the dud. You know, again, this episode is just so smart about how these characters interact with one another, how they're sort of seen by themselves, you know, how they see themselves, how the world sees them. And it extends that empathy and that kind of grace to these new characters, this group of kids that Lisa meets, one of whom is voiced by Christina Ricci. And they're not that fleshed out, but there is at least a little bit of detail that these kids could easily be just parodies of slacker Gen X-y, you know, sort of mentality trickled down to the youth of 1996. And they are that a little bit, but they have a little depth to it. And in that, I think this episode broadens its humanist view, which we can hear a little of in clip 7.
Pretty cool your mom to let us hang out here.
Totally. Not like my mom, as she'd be butting in with Rice Krispie squares and Tang.
My dad's all stoked because today's the 4th of July. He woke me up at dawn to take a loyalty oath.
My mom's French, so we only celebrate Bastille Day.
Well, we could do something fun. How about a beach party?
Oh, great idea, Lise.
Yeah, I know where there's a beach.
I know where we can get some baguettes.
A totally unnecessary line, the baguettes, but it's so funny. And I think the detail about this kid being having a French parent is such a great stand-in for the way that a kid like Lisa or a kid like me or any of us really saw a certain exotic quality in kids that we didn't know, that weren't from our school, that seemed to kind of wander in from this whole impossible to imagine life. A French parent. I mean, it's so different. And I think that Dan Greeny putting that little detail in there really helps deepen the portraits we're getting in this episode. But really, this episode is about this. It is a Lisa episode, but it's also about the sibling dynamic she and Bart share. And as Lisa makes these tentative first steps into a friendship that is fleeting, she's not staying there the whole summer. She knows that, but it's more like to prove to herself that she can do it. Bart is feeling, as siblings often are, left behind. And so he's getting glummer and glummer and angrier about that, which leads to a moment where I think quite winningly, the show has a little meta dialogue with itself about who Bart has been in terms of being the best-selling t-shirts and toys. He was the breakout star of that show in its early years, maybe deliberately done by Fox. And there's a moment in this episode where they kind of comment on that and speak to their own show's evolution in addition to the evolution of the character within the world of the show. And that's clip 8.
Oh, this is the worst 4th of July ever. I hate America. Come on, Milhouse, let's go down there.
I don't think you should. Let Lisa be alone with her new friends.
They're my friends, rightfully. She only got them by copying me. See? That's my expression.
No, you haven't said that in 4 years. Let Lisa have it.
It's the principal. She's got to learn.
No. Now park your keister, meester.
Ay, caramba!
So in reaction to that, Bart does what siblings often do, is he seeks to embarrass Lisa, to put her back in her place, by showing these cool kids the evidence of Lisa's nerdiness, which is, of course, the yearbook. So it's a nice little mirroring from the beginning of the episode, this yearbook kind of looming large as it did for lots of kids, you know, every year when you would get people to sign or not. And Lisa is understandably really sad about that, really hurt. But the episode, as a lot of Simpsons episodes do, manages some sentiment. There is a happy-ish ending. It's a bittersweet ending. It's a very summery ending, a very tween-age ending, and where Lisa kind of realizes that she can be both a person who's growing up, but also still her. And I think that this episode, I think, is really that ethos has been carried in the best young adult fiction, my book, of course, but I think most keenly about like the Babysitter's Club series on Netflix that is so good about showing how you know, kids at that age just get kind of stuck between like who they were, who they're going to be, who they want to be, and then hopefully arrive at a place of reconciliation between those things, that they can be both, that they can just be themselves. And that, you know, as evidenced in a way earlier episode, getting a letter that says you are Lisa Simpson is one of the best gifts you can get. So that's clip 9.
Being myself didn't work. Being someone else didn't work. Maybe I just wasn't meant to have friends.
Lisa is gonna freak when she sees this.
Well, hurry up. They'll be back soon. Lisa!
Okay, you found out I'm an overachieving bookworm. So whatever mean prank you're pulling, just finish it up and send me a Polaroid. I'm going to sleep.
Well, wait, Lisa! Look!
Well, now you can take the beach with you wherever you go. But don't drive at night.
Does this mean you still want to be friends? Even though I tried to cover up my nerdish leanings?
Look, we don't care who you were. You can't fake the kind of good person that you are.
Yeah, you taught us about cool things like nature and why we shouldn't drink seawater.
This is the most thoughtful thing anybody ever...
Sweet, merciful crap! My car!
Sweet, merciful crap, my car is a line I still quote. Speaking of things I still quote, we don't have a clip of it because it's a visual joke, but Milhouse signs for yearbook and he says, see you in the car, best wishes, Milhouse. And I still sometimes sign birthday cards, see you in the car. This is a classic episode of the show. It's the show at its best. It is sweet. It is thoughtful. It's kind of deep. It's resonant. It is screamingly funny with the typical Simpsons, you know, esoteric references and asides and all that. It's just kind of the perfect package and was a great way, I think, to close a season and to give us all stuff to think about as we ourselves now enter summer. And that's why Summer of 4 Foot Two is my canon submission.
That was lovely. Thank you, Richard. Sarah, why don't you start?
I really enjoyed this because of how The Simpsons is good when it's at its best, which has, you know, been a maybe decade or two now. But in this sort of peak period of The Simpsons, that in a single line or two or a single reference or two, they could just sort of open a window or give you a glance into a ton of sort of felt experience on the part of the writers.
Yeah.
And like that the game left behind was Mystery Date. Of course. Like that's, yeah. I mean, that's every summer cottage, or it's like the Knight Rider game and the actual little car piece is missing. because I stole it to complete Dave's set that I got him on Etsy. But the, like the way that moms sometimes can't like come forward into that liminal space with you, they just do in like a single line where she's like, what about this bathing suit? It has a starfish on the fanny. And you're just like, oh, girl. Like the endless unpronounceable name of the town that they go to. Like the only note I would give is that the unpronounceable names are often like six letters long. I said like C-O-T-U-I-T. If anyone is a native, please tell me how it's pronounced. I still don't know. I'm 48. But that's one of the really enjoyable things about this episode to me is that it not only is it describing this liminal space and this very familiar, particularly to a, you know, bookwormish tween emerita, like the potential of summer to reinvent yourself as better or like more acceptable somehow. And the bittersweetness of all the summers sort of spent hoping for that and trying to do that. But then there's all these jokes about it, and they're able to do it really quickly and with just a couple of like one broad stroke and then one fine stroke. And it's really sort of a pleasure to watch this occurring in this episode, which is also hilarious. And like, you know, my own Bart, my brother Dave, has signed numerous birthday cards from like when we used to live together in the same house, like see you in the yard, Millhouse. Like, okay. And I really just also want to say that this presentation is like not the direction I saw this coming from. And it was really a delight to examine in this particular, from this particular exegetical angle. Sorry, don't get up. I'll fire.
That's how you pronounce the town of Cape Cod, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you.
Digital angle. Yeah.
Thank you. But yeah, like there's just enough Flanders in this. There's just enough Millhouse in this. It really is like all the things in perfect balance. And sometimes when The Simpsons tries to like have a good ending before the reset, for especially for Lisa, it can be a little treacly, but I think they hit this one exactly right. I also wanted to note that Grammar Rodeo Head Buckaroo, which is how some of my birthday cards have been addressed by my brother at times, is a great sight gag. Don't make me get the carny is something that we say in this house pretty often, actually. This was a great and a great episode for summer too. So great presentation, fun episode to revisit, and so that town in Cape Cod, at me please, Tara.
If we're talking about lines from this episode that we still say in our various households, was President Lincoln okay? I know you're joking, but it is. The whole thing smacks of effort.
Trying it as a maritime offense is something that I'll be working into the rotation.
Yes.
I don't know what you have planned for tonight, but keep me out of it.
But count me out. Yeah. I mean, to back up to the maritime offense thing with Flanders, like just his imagining the probably day in the writer's room that they spent deciding, like, what is Ned rambling on about, where Homer is like, come on, come on, come on, just like making that gesture. the car hit a decorative boat and they're trying it as a maritime offense is so smart and brilliant.
Oh, God.
But yeah, I agree with Sarah that Richard's lovely take on this about this, you know, this transitional time when the worst thing you can imagine is someone thinking you're a baby. And mm-hmm. like the details of like the clothes that Marge picks out in the store are yes. so, they're just so perfectly selected as an mm-hmm. example. I mean, the starship on, and the fact that she says Fanny as opposed mm-hmm. to like
Fanny,
that word over like derriere or patoot or whatever mm-hmm. other folksy thing Marge might say is, you know, it's perfect. Cause as Richard said, we all had a summer where we tried to be someone else, like at camp or with whatever activities you were doing. And like, you know, because of the way The Simpsons is, we can't see Lisa like continuing on the hockey team right. and like having great times with them. Like, this is just not how the show is.
Mm-hmm.
So this episode perfectly captures like, you know, what it's like to try to be someone else. But ultimately, she is still herself. Like, you know, even though the line that we heard that Richard had clipped where, you know, being myself didn't work, being someone else didn't work. When we see her with the cool kids, she's not actually that different. Like, we have the moment with them where she's teaching them about tide pools and stuff. Like, she's still a nerd and it's okay. She just had to have the confidence boost of, you know, the tie-dyed shirt and the John
teeny
Lennon sunglasses.
Oh, girl. Yeah, exactly. Awful.
She looks like Blossom.
She looks like Blossom. Yeah. This is, as I said to Dave, this is a stealth classic episode. I don't think anyone... I mean, I'm sure some people do. I don't think it's in, like, the pantheon of episodes people really necessarily have top of mind of, like, classic, hilarious Simpsons episodes. And yet, when you watch it, it's like, holy shit, this hits on every level. Mm-hmm. So, excellent suggestion, Richard. Excellent, excellent presentation. Dave.
Yeah, I agree. Stealth classic is a perfect way to put it. Because when I saw this title, I'm like, really? That one? Because all I remembered about this episode, not having ingested it in the way that I ingested some Simpsons classics, was that I just kind of remember the kids being kind of un-Simpson-y, you know, like the kids at the beach, they were like real kids. And for some reason, that kind of like put the episode off kilter for me in my mind. But then rewatching it, I was like scene after scene, line after line, just like the silliness of those quotes that we've all been talking about. And just one after the other, I'm like, wow, there are like seven things that are in my like dialogue repertoire that mm-hmm. I forgot were all from this one episode.
Yeah.
And that's saying something.
It's really strong.
Yeah. Straw poll, which sprinkler is the best, by the way? Is it or
sweeper?
Back and forth.
Sweeper, yeah.
First one.
You're right. Richard, sweeper?
Yeah, the first one. That's what we had in my yard, so yeah.
Because it's easiest to control where it is.
Yep.
The one that you have to, like, put a stake in the ground and it sweeps in arcs or semi-arcs. First of all,
those hurt.
But the arcs always change as the sprinkler smacks the, you know, the hardware around, so that mm-hmm. doesn't worry. It's agreed. It's the sweeper.
If you're going to be running through a sprinkler, you need to have the tall one so that you can
get
through it and get full coverage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's be that stupid kid always gets too close to the sprinkler and puts out an eye. The one part that I totally forgot was in this episode because it was not shown in syndication was when Bart and Milhouse run to the beach excitedly, jump in the ocean, slam in their faces into the slightly moist sand because it is low tide, which is announced by Homer, who is driving his car through the beach at low tide, squealing his wheels around. It was such like a perfect, stupid Homer moment.
Yep.
And it's like right in that transition zone between goofy, fun-loving, dumb Homer and what would become total idiot Homer later in the series, which was unfortunate. Like, this is crazy uncle energy.
Yes. Bombing the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bart saying, this is the worst 4th of July ever, following it up, therefore, I hate America, is a great line and like such a perfect kid logic sort of moment. Smacks of effort is something I probably say at least once a week.
Yeah.
But getting to the heart of the episode that, you know, there are these opportunities in your life where you evaluate yourself and you think, I'm not what I need to be in order to get what I want, which is more friends and more accolades or whatever it is. Like, I never had this experience where I went somewhere for the summer. I never went to camp or anything like that took me away from home for an extended period of time like this. So the first opportunity I had where I thought about this was when I went to high school.
Yeah.
And then once again in university, when, of course, the high school thing didn't work out because you can't go against your true nature.
No.
You know, there were it went from I got VIC 20 programs to debug to I got Commodore 64 programs to I got Pentium 386 programs to debug. It's just like it's just same story, different year. But I do remember going to university thinking, all right, when I get there, this is new Dave. New Dave might have an alcoholic drink. Maybe. probably not. But maybe I'll make people think I do. And, you know, it doesn't matter. You are who you are. But I really felt that sort of compunction to reinvent yourself. So I did like the tack that Richard took for this article, for this argument. But I have to say, this episode is rich with just premium Simpsons-isms. And yep. I totally forgot about that. And the fact that it puts it all together in this package, those juicy 8 years of The Simpsons where they can marry heart without being sappy, mm-hmm. where they can introduce jokes without being totally random, where it all integrated, was what made these years of The Simpsons so good and something they just really could not reproduce as the years went on when they just sort of leaned back on the stupidness of everything. Stealth classic for sure. Let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
I think this is the starfish on the fanny of the canon, so I'm going to say yes.
Tara Ariano.
It's two baguettes up for me for Richard, yes. For me as well.
Me too. That means that The Simpsons Season 7, Episode 25, The Summer of 4'2", you're hereby inducted into the Extra. Craig Cannon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It is Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill, which is getting an HBO docuseries adaptation. There was also a podcast that I was just kind of like a B- about because I think the material didn't quite translate to that medium, or he sort of went and interview like Chautauqua way with it that I was not wild about. But based on his participation in the Dylan Farrow project, I think he probably has some contacts over there. This is Ronan Farrow, by the way. It's his book about the Weinstein case. So I'm looking forward to that. And it's a great book.
Loser of the week.
Well, we got a couple of shit shows. I'm going to say dishonorable mention to CNN for letting Jeffrey Toobin return to the air last week after his widely publicized masturbating on Zoom in a New Yorker meeting last year.
Like, apparently CNN Christopher decides Darden is available.
Yeah.
Get him.
I think I said it at the time, and it just reminded me every time I hear about this story. In my mind, Saber Dance is playing.
Yeah.
Oh.
But okay, I get it. But that's just a dishonorable mention. Our actual loser this week is NBC's Ultimate Slip and Slide, a competition show that was supposed to come to the air, I believe, in August. But it has had to halt production after dozens of crew members got violently ill with awful explosive diarrhea. And we don't always link to the stories for winner and loser, but I'm going to highlight this one. Sarah's doing the copy this week, and make sure she includes it because the lead pick that NBC, that the rap chose to illustrate this story is absolutely horrifying. It's someone on a slip and slide with, I hope it's mud. It's a photo illustration with, you know, a number of porta potties on the side. It's just horrifying. So, I mean, I assume they're sliding on water mostly, but if you've ever been to a water park, you know those are just petri dishes of E. coli. So I think we can all probably guess what happened here. But yeah, RIP to everyone who worked on that production because they're dead of Giardia by now.
Attention, attention, all slip and sliders. There has been a slide fouling. Please exit the water slide.
Yeah.
See, we're about fouling. Do you know what time it is?
Oh, well done. It's game time. That.
Pool fouling is one of my favorite things. Just like the, somebody
it's
thought
so
of
genteel.
That. There's been a pool fouling.
Yeah. This is what I used to be a pool tester, actually, 30 years ago. And this is how the, you know, junior lifeguard would greet you at the gate. Like, don't even bother. It's been It's been fouled.
It happened at my summer camp, my day camp. Someone pooped in the pool, and we had to not, we couldn't swim for the rest of the week.
Oh no.
It's really tragic. Yeah.
There's like it state really is. Statutes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good because this game's all about TV fouling.
News you can use, folks.
All right. This is the 10th game time of the season. The scores are Tara 4, Value Guess 4, both within one of a season victory, and Sarah behind with just 1 point so far. Today we are playing role-playing game, and it's back-to-back Potsy games. Potsy's back, and he earns himself yet another extra credit topic for his trouble. In RPG, you will identify the actor from five TV shows they've been in the most. I will read you TV shows an actor has been on, starting with the fifth most, going to the show they've been in the most episodes.
Got it.
You get one guess to figure out who I'm talking about. And if you guess it on the fifth most show, you get 5 points. You guess it on the first show, 1 point. Make sense?
Yes.
That's pretty much it. So just please be quick with your guess or next hints, because there are five shows to get through.
Got it.
Sure.
We're not going to do steel mills. We're not doing Grossworth Ecologer Challenge Zones because of the nature of the game. So let's just throw it to Piggy to see who's going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, Tara, Sarah, Richard is our order today. 24 questions. Are we ready to play role-playing game?
Yes. Good luck, everybody.
Good luck.
I'm scared.
I'm starting. This is going to be the show they've been in
the fifth most. Yep.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Okay, proceed.
Handmaid's Tale.
Proceed.
Trophy Wife.
I still don't know. Keep going.
Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Oh, Bradley Whitford.
Bradley Whitford. That gives you 2 points. Ford. Number one is, of course, West Wing.
Of course.
To Sarah. Designated Survivor.
Next, please.
Boston Legal.
Next, please.
The Good Wife.
Next, please.
Spin City.
Michael J. Fox.
Also good for two.
Well done.
Two and two. To Richard. Salem.
Definitely next, please.
Battlestar Galactica.
Okay, next.
Spartacus.
Lucy Lawless.
Lucy Lawless.
Hey!
3 points. Nice. Nicely done. Okay, back to Tara.
Yes.
The Originals.
Next.
Containment.
Next.
Stargate SG-1.
Oh, God, it's some Canadian. Next.
A Country Practice.
It's some British person? Next.
Farscape. Good luck.
Oh, God.
Oh, space.
I have no idea. It's not Bruce Boxleitner, obviously, so I'm out.
Claudia Black.
Okay, sure.
Right. Tricky one. Yep. Sarah.
Yep.
Cutters.
Next. Cutters.
Class of 96.
Class of 96. Oh, geez. Oh, next.
The Fix.
Next.
Prison Break.
Dominic Purcell?
Last one was The Mentalist.
Oh.
Robin Tunney?
Robin Tunney, correct.
These got exponentially harder in round two.
Originally, they were alphabetized, and I just did them randomly. So some they were popping all over difficulty, so you're going to get
I'm
easy.
I'm like, where's Ted Danson? Okay.
all right, Richard. Bleak House.
Gillian Anderson.
Yeah! Yes! Whoa. Amazing!
5 points. The Fall, Sex Education, Hannibal, X-Files.
Gorgeous.
Damn.
I can also say that in a British accent if you'd like.
Please.
I'm not going to do it now.
Oh, okay.
ER, Tara.
Yep. Keep going.
The Big C.
Keep going.
Ray Donovan.
Oh, no. keep going.
The second show they're in the most, West Wing.
Okay. So many people were in the West Wing, though. Last one.
MASH.
Alan Alda?
Alan Alda is correct. 1 point. Sarah. Burning Love.
Next, please.
Good Place.
Next.
House of Lies.
Next.
Veronica Mars.
Kristen Bell?
Kristen Bell. What was the number one show for Kristen Bell?
Gossip Girl?
Gossip Girl.
Correct. Oh, of course.
All right, back to Richard. Mm-hmm. Alias Grace.
Next.
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Next.
Heroes Reborn.
Oh, God. Next.
Less Than Perfect.
Next.
Lastly, Chuck.
I don't remember. Levy something? I don't remember.
Zachary Levy will take that. Good for one.
Nice.
Tara.
Yep.
The Code.
Next.
Kidnapped.
Next.
Hand of God.
Oh. Wow. Shit. Next. Next.
Honk. Desperate Housewives.
Dana Delaney?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct. Allie McBeal, Sarah.
Allie McBeal. Next.
One Life to Live.
Next.
Guiding Light.
This guy loves soaps.
Oh, Jesus. Next.
Heroes.
Hayden Panettiere?
Yes. Wow. Nashville number one.
Well done.
Back to Richard. Deception.
Okay, next.
Justice.
Next.
Eli Stone.
Sorry, I talked over that.
Eli Stone, you said?
Eli Stone.
Okay, next.
Legends of Tomorrow.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Number one, Alias.
Oh,
Victor Garber.
Spy Daddy.
Forgot he was in here.
I should have waited.
Tara.
Yep.
The Astronaut Wives Club.
Yvonne Strahovski.
5 points. Hey! 24. Whoa. Dexter, Handmaid's Tale, Chuck.
Hello, the only person who watched all of Astronaut Wives Club right here. I was just going to say,
the only
right
person
here.
Who watched that show, including the Astronauts' Wives.
Well, you're in it. You're in the club, so.
That's true.
All right, Sarah DeBundy. Fargo. Fargo.
Next.
West Wing.
Jesus. Next.
Deadline.
Next.
The Big C.
Next.
Chicago Med.
Come on.
I thought I knew and then I didn't.
Once again, Fargo, West either. Wing, Deadline, Big C, Chicago Med.
I don't know. Allison someone?
Anybody want to take a crack at that
one? Is it
one
Oliver for... Platt?
Oliver Platt.
Yeah. Oh, Plattsy. Sorry, buddy.
All right, this will take us into our score break for Richard. Grey's Anatomy.
Okay, next.
Murphy Brown.
Next.
Christy.
Next.
Cagney and Lacey.
Tyne Daly.
2 points.
Nice.
All right. Let's hear the scores, please, Tara.
Well, it's a very close game. Sarah has 6 points. I have 9 points. Richard has 11 points.
All right. Everybody has 4 questions left.
Okay.
Lots of points with four questions to be had. Here we go. Back to it. For Tara.
Yep.
Deepwater Black.
Next.
Private Eyes.
Next.
You get this, I'll give you $1 million.
Okay.
Neat.
Next.
Catwalk.
Next.
Star Trek Deep Space Nine. That's God. Number two.
I at least know some of the people who are on that. Why not? Nana Visitor.
Dead Zone, number one. That smacks of Canadian television. That's Nicole DeBoer, who played the symbiont in the Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
Tough one. Sarah.
Yeah.
Heroes.
Next.
Silicon Valley.
Next.
Californication.
Next.
The Goldbergs.
Nope. Next.
One Day at a Time, new version. Heroes, Silicon Valley, Californication, Goldbergs, and The Most is One Day at a Time.
I don't know who it's going to be. Tobolowsky?
Yes.
Neat.
Nicely done.
Well done.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, Richard.
Yeah.
Richard, Once Upon a Time.
Next.
Life Unexpected.
Next.
Beverly Hills 90210.
Next.
General Hospital.
Next.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, number one. Once Upon a Time, Life Unexpected, Beverly Hills 90210, General Hospital, Buffy.
Anthony Head?
That'd be
any
awesome.
Guesses from the, again, no. With his crowd?
I didn't know there was any crossover between Buffy and 90210.
Emma Caulfield.
Oh, of course. I
should have gotten that. That's genuinely infuriating.
Two questions left for everybody. Back to Tara.
Okay.
Glee.
Yep. Keep going.
The Stand.
Mike O'Malley.
Wow, nice.
Baghdad Cafe. Foxbusters. Star Trek Next Generation.
No. Oh, Jesus.
That's not, these are scripted, of course. Yeah. If it was true number one TV, it would be The View or whatever she's in. That's Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, there she is.
Sarah. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Next.
Masters of Sex.
Next.
Away. Remember Away?
Away. Yeah. Next.
Sports Night.
Next.
Good Wife.
No.
Sports Night, good Wife. You know this.
Do I?
Yes.
No, I don't. Oh, yes, I do. Josh Charles. Thank you.
1 point. Richard.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Donovan.
Oh. Okay, next.
Kings.
Ian McShane.
Yes, yeah! 4 points. American Gods, Deadwood, Lovejoy.
Oh, someone else watched Kings.
This guy.
I love Kings.
All right, this is everybody's last question. So let's get a score update, please, Star.
Okay. It is not anyone's game. Sarah has 8 points. I have 9 points. Richard has 15 points.
All right.
Yeah, he does.
Back to Tara.
Yep.
Get Shorty.
Okay.
Frasier.
Next.
American Crime.
Oh, no. Next.
Sports Night.
Felicity Huffman?
Yes, 2 points. Remember she was in Get Shorty for like a hot second at the start of the series?
I forgot Get Shorty was a series, so.
That was that show they filmed in prison, right?
Yeah. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, your last question. Dirty, Sexy Money.
Next.
Sports Night.
Jesus, so much for my Donald Sutherland guess. Next.
9-1-1.
Oh, Krause?
Krause, 3 points, 6 feet under, Parenthood. Last question on regulation for Richard. Your number five show, Being Human.
Which version?
I don't know.
Okay.
Next.
Our good friend Salem is back. Your good friend Salem is back from question number one, I believe.
Next.
24.
Okay, next.
Walking Dead.
Oh, God. Next.
Nikita is the number one Ending off with a hard one. Being Human, Salem, 24, Walking Dead, Nikita.
Maggie Q?
Incorrect. That's Xander Berkeley.
Oh, of course. Sure. Yeah. That guy.
All right, that is regulations. So scores, please, Dara.
Okay, Sarah and I both finished strong with 11 points. But Richard is our winner today at For the Season with 15.
Yeah. Threw all a right. foot up our fannies.
Richard!
Before nice work.
We get to all the celebrations. We do have the tiebreaker, which we do not need, but we'll play for a future steel mill. Anybody can answer to this. When you think you know it, just guess.
Okay.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Single Ladies.
Okay.
Equalizer.
Queen Latifah.
Queen Latifah. Star and then Living Single. So, Tara, you get one more steel mill for your troubles. But today is...
Valued Guest!
Valued Guest!
And wins them the season!
Course by course, one by one, till you shout. Sing you off to sleep as you digest. Tonight you'll prop your feet up, but for now let's eat up. Be our guest, be our guest, be our guest. Please be our guest.
Woo!
Richard!
Congratulations.
Thank you. I got easier questions, I think, but I'll take it.
No. I mean, Salem twice.
Yeah, seriously.
Take the W.
Richard clinches it for the value guests. I believe that's the second season victory for the value guests. Second or third, anyways.
Woo!
Woo! Well, that is it awesome. For another episode of Extra Hot Great. We spend some time talking about Marvel's Loki before going around the dial with stops at Younger, Starstruck, Bargain Block, Crime Scene Kitchen, and Housewife and the Hustler. We clowned around with David's extra credit question, and Richard got the Simpsons Beach Vacation episode Summer of 4 Foot 2 into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Richard was the winner of this week's Game Time, clinching the season for the valued guests. Next up, Game Time on Your Time on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, it's physical. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole on behalf of Tara Ariano.
What happened at Ford's Theater?
Sarah D. Bunting.
Last one in is a yearbook editor.
And the victorious Richard Lawson.
Goodbye, Mr. Brown Ground.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Oh, so much poo.
Gee, I don't know what you've got planned for tonight, Homer, but count me out.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.